Thank you for staying with us. Money Talk, eliminating the black-white wealth gap. What's it going to take continues now. I'm Harold Fisher. A reminder for you, no phone calls tonight, but please join the conversation online using the hashtag Money Talk. My guests are economist and author Dr. Julian Malveaux, Dr. Curtis Kidd-Telemach, director of the HPS Center for Financial Excellence, Howard University School of Business, and wealth coach LaShawn Holland. Okay, LaShawn, like I said, we can talk about your vacation real quick because everybody's trying to keep up with the Hollands.
We are not going to talk about my vacation.
Okay, good.
Right. You don't talk about everything else. Let's hear about the vacation.
Yeah, right. LaShawn, let's talk, first of all, about this cryptocurrency thing. Everybody's talking about it. Not everybody understands it. Can you give me the cryptocurrency 101? Give me an explanation, please.
Absolutely. So it's a digital currency that works as a medium of exchange on a distributed ledger technology called the blockchain, which gives transactions a unique, unhackable fingerprint, if you will. And so one of the most defining features about cryptocurrency is that they're generally issued without central bank having any authority over them and really rendering them immune to governmental interference or manipulation.
Is it real money?
It depends on which cryptocurrency. I mean, there's an argument, there's a big argument right now whether XRP, which is also considered a cryptocurrency, is it the same as Bitcoin? I believe that it is real money because it acts as a medium exchange. We can buy just about anything with cryptocurrency now that you want to be able to get. There are large corporations now that are recognizing cryptocurrency. In the United States alone, there are over 300 companies that are in large companies that are recognizing cryptocurrency as a medium of exchange. And you have large corporations that are starting to add cryptocurrency to their balance sheet. So if it wasn't real money, you know, companies would not be using it as a medium of exchange and adding it to their balance sheet.
Is it a safe place to put your money? And so this is why I ask. Because when information about cryptocurrency first started coming out, about a decade ago or so?
Yeah, 2009.
Is it 2009?
2009.
Yeah, so we're talking closer to almost 15 years. The value of cryptocurrency was a few dollars, a coin. Let's talk about Bitcoin, for example. Now we're talking about, it's at about what, $45,000 a coin. There was a point at which it went so much higher and there were people who were making money hand over fist. But then there were also people who were losing money as well, because when they started jumping in and the value dropped, it became concerning. What causes it to go up and down? Is it like the stock market? And I ask again, is it a safe place? Is it an investment? Is it gambling? How would you characterize it?
I would, because I do own crypto, I would categorize it as an investment. I have the opportunity to make money, but just like any investment, you can lose money. There's an opportunity for you to be able to lose money. That's why I believe being able to read the charts are so important. So you can see that there's ways that you can make money in crypto. And I believe that eventually, given enough time, it's going to mimic and act just like stocks do, just like options do. Right. And I think it's important. That's why education is so paramount. So I can learn about it. When things drop, I have one or two things. I can either get out or I can buy more. Right. People say when it's on sale, go shopping. I don't necessarily buy into that, but there are opportunities for you to make what I call a millionaire's rate of return versus me having my money at a Merrill Lynch and possibly only getting 6 or 8% or whatever the percentage is right now that they're going. You have an opportunity with crypto to make larger returns in a short period of time. And I think that is what makes it so attractive for millennials and, you know, the younger generation, is because the control that they have over cryptocurrency, meaning that they can manage their money by themselves without paying Wall Street thousands of dollars in fees every year in these top-loaded funds. The fast growth also is important to them too, because you're able to compound your money at higher rates faster. And so that's what makes it so attractive. And then it gives them the freedom of not having, being able to have these golden handcuffs for 40 years, because this generation doesn't want to wait 40 years to be able to live the life it is that they want. They want to be able to live it now while they're here. And so it is an investment, but just like stocks, there's risks that come along with it. That's why it's important for you to know how to position. I don't believe money is ever lost in the stock market. It merely changes hands to the people who know how to be in position. And so, you know, if you ask the House of Holland, we know how to position ourselves, whether the market is up, down, sideways, stagnant. And so that's why education is so paramount. And you can do the same thing inside of cryptocurrencies. I'm not a big fan of Bitcoin. I do own Bitcoin, not a big fan of Bitcoin, but I love XRP because in fintech, you have so many different financial institutions that are building on that particular platform. And so it's a much safer platform for me than Bitcoin. But cryptocurrency is a very volatile market. And because it's also unregulated by the government, which makes it appealing to most people, you know, it's important for us to be able to know what we're doing inside of the crypto market.
Harold, I got to push back.
I was going to say, go right ahead, Dr. Melvo.
I really got to push back here because, I mean, she's right about the whole issue of education and financial education. I am not a fan of any of this stuff. None of this stuff can be verified. It's extraordinarily volatile. People are making lots of money, but people are also losing lots of money. My thing about any investment is don't invest anything that you cannot afford to lose. Because with this Bitcoin crap, and I call it crap, I'm very skeptical about it. I would not have, I don't own any of it, and I don't intend to. I don't want anybody I know to own any of it. And if y'all do, that's your business. But I just really think it's not real. It's not regulated. It's not guaranteed. There's no FDIC or any other organization that's saying we will keep you whole and keep you safe. To me, it's like a high rolling Las Vegas experiment. And you know, you go to Vegas and put some quarters in a slot.
It's 11 o'clock.
And get a bunch of money out. You can go to Vegas and put some money in a slot and get none. And that's what it seems to me that crypto is. I respectfully disagree with my sister here. I just would not have anybody, and especially anybody over 50, because if you're 30 and you lose a bunch of money, you can make it back. If you're 50 or 60 and you lose a bunch of money, what kind of time do you have to make it back? So I am
absolutely, I agree with you. Oh,
talking, sister, I'm talking. I am not a crypto Bitcoin fan. And I think it's very, very dangerous.
LaShawn.
So I agree with you on the part of, you know, depending on your time horizon of investing. You know, if you're maybe in your ladder of your Generation X or your baby boomer, it would literally take 100% for you to make up to even break back even when you lose money. But you can lose money in any market reset. I have had clients call me who were 3 years out from retirement in 2008, 2009. And when the market crashed, they lost 67% of their money. And so you can lose money. And I've had clients come in right at retirement and their jobs made a bad investment. Heck, my mother-in-law worked for Howard University for years, and they made a bad investment at the time. And so she lost over $80,000 of her money. And so if just because you have your money with a brokerage firm investing, doesn't exclude you from losing money.
They're charlatans, and you know that they're charlatans. They are charlatans. And there's no way to basically verify any of this. It's all about, I mean, investing always is all about what people think, even with the stock market. What do you think? How much confidence do you have? But with this Bitcoin stuff, no. Of course, I am 68. I tell it because I don't look it, so I will tell it. So it's not for me. But I do think that people have to be extraordinarily cautious. I would never put more, I would never even advise a youngin to more put more than 10% of their portfolio in that nonsense.
Dr. Telemann.
Harold, let me come in the middle, right? And so the reason I'm in the middle is because at the Center for Financial Excellence, we did just have a Bitcoin workshop. It was actually DFI workshop, Deregulated Financial Instruments, I believe is what it's called. And in general, my background is as an equities trader, so a stock trader as well as options. And I did not buy into any crypto. But if I put my asset manager hat on, then what I have to teach my students is that we are looking for risk-adjusted returns. And so I think your original question was, is Bitcoin a safe investment? And based on some of the metrics that we use to determine risk, i.e. the Sharpe ratio, it would probably not be considered safe, but a lot of investments that are considered safe also don't return you, a significant return over a shorter period of time. And so therefore, if you had a portfolio of $1 million or so, I think Dr. Malvo said, you know, something like 10%, the likelihood is that a cognizant asset manager would, depending on what it is that you needed to do with your money and the time horizon, would put a portion of that $1 million inside of an investment that is poised to make 20%. But with that 20%, you also have to be ready to lose that 20%. Versus, I don't know, a U.S. stock bond or something of the sort, where the likelihood is that you will reap the return on investment that you thought. It would just be way lower.
Dr. Telemark, I do want to move forward and talk about some other investment vehicles. Where should we put our money? Let's talk about stocks. They remain volatile, but some could argue that America's wealth after the crash of 1929 and the recovery of the stock market, and we've had some ups and downs and the like, but America's wealth has been built on stocks and bonds. Let's talk about the two of them. What is a stock? What is a bond? I know this may be basic, but there are some people who are still struggling with investing with their 401k. So let's talk about that. Let's sure. give so you let's, stock 101.
So let's go with stock 101 first, right? So a stock is pretty much partial ownership into a publicly traded company, right? And so let's sort of peel away some of these things, that the terminology that I'm using here. Publicly traded company means that in general, a particular company has filed its paperwork, its accounting paperwork, and therefore its transparency into the company with the SEC and other regulatory bodies of the United States, if we're talking about publicly traded here in the United States. And you are offered, if you invest in this particular company, you are offered a portion of the dividends that this particular company makes, a portion of the profits. And sometimes, or you are offered a particular piece of ownership, depending on how many shares of that particular company you buy, and its growth and ascension, right? So in general, that's what a stock is. A bond is a bit different insofar as you are almost acting as a bank. You are lending money to a particular agency or corporation with the notion that you will receive the money back plus some interest over a particular amount of time. And so when you lend that money to that company can, I don't know, do whatever it needs to do to grow, or it could pay its employees, all sorts of things. Whatever companies do, it is specific to the operations of the company.
Now, let me stop there, because for those who may not have an idea of a good example, here in the state of Maryland, and for those who have been kind of paying attention to the news, and we hope that you always do, the state of Maryland, just a week ago at the close of the legislative session, approved a $400 million bond. The Maryland Stadium Authority is issuing these bonds for improvement of the area around FedEx Field, where the Washington Commanders play. So they are now making these bonds available. So if I wanted to buy these bonds, what would happen to my money as a result of that?
Yeah, so this, what you're discussing is a municipal bond, and typically, typically muni bonds are used for tax shelters of people like you, Harold, who wear nice suits and are financial literate, right? And so what your broker would probably do is say, hey, look, Harold, you're making too much money. Let's shelter some of your Maryland taxes inside a muni bond, and let's loan the state of Maryland $40,000 or so, right? And you will, so therefore you have some tax implications there where you can be sheltered with the $40,000, and for the state of Maryland, they will receive this $40,000, use it for whatever that muni bond is designated to be used for, as you have just said, to clean up around FedEx Field, and use it towards the operations of that particular thing. And then after X amount of years, they will pay you the $40,000 back. And because you loaned it out, they will also pay you back 8% or 9% interest or whatever it may be.
Real quick, because I've got a couple of other issues that I want everyone to get to. Annuities. You hear a lot about annuities as well. What is an annuity?
Yeah, and so I actually like annuities. Insurance products are not necessarily my thing. As I told you, I cut my teeth in equities. But from what I know of annuity products, it is basically you are putting your money somewhere so that after a certain amount of time, you will have fixed payments of that money for the duration of X. And so a lot of times annuities are probably more closely aligned with those who would maybe coming towards the retirement stage of their life, where they have put money towards a product, in this case it'd be an annuity product or insurance product, and at a certain time, call it 65, right? Then at 65 on to 85 or 95, you receive a fixed payment, right? Based on the amount of your annuity.
Mm-hmm. LaShawn, I want to go to your wheelhouse real quick. Real estate, you know, land and the like. You know, Oprah Winfrey said, you know, buy land because they don't make any more of that. Your thoughts about investing in real estate and land, for example?
Yeah. You know, real estate was one of the ways, or actually the largest, that gave us our start. So I am a really, really big fan of real estate. Like any asset class, though, there are cycles and bubbles, and knowing when to get out and when to get in is very, very important. And a lot of times, because people don't understand the cycles of asset classes or investing, they may get in at the wrong time. I am always going to be a real estate fan because I believe that, you know, consistent cash flow is better than capital gains any day of the week. And so I think it's very important, like anything else, that you educate yourself on understanding the cycles, not just in real estate, but in any asset class.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the tax? No, go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Telemark.
So I've been relatively quiet, and most of my students know I'm not that quiet, but I just wanted to touch on one small thing, which was actually a broader issue that our guests talked about, which is the diminishing wealth over time, over generations. So with respect to real estate, this is just one component. With respect to real estate, it has been noted, I don't have the quantifying figures here, that African Americans pay more with respect to their mortgages than our white counterparts. And so therefore, so let's say LaShawn purchases a home and has a mortgage of 5%. The likelihood is that her white counterpart has a mortgage of 3%, probably a 200 basis point gap, right? Then she maybe leaves her home to her first offspring, right? And they do a refi, and the refi is now at 6%. Let's just say that interest rates go up. The likelihood is that her white counterpart now has a refi of 4%, still a 2% wealth gap. And she is paying more for her mortgage. And therefore, now you can see how the cost of the property that she has is actually increasing because her mortgage is increasing. So at this particular case, I just wanted to lay it out that sometimes what Dr. Malvo had described as, I think it was something envy, economic envy. You can see it more prevalent in things like purchasing a mortgage for a Black person versus a white person. And if it continues with the same cycle that we had seen for so long, that is where you also get some of your diminishing asset returns.
And you know what? I need to jump in here, Harold, just to say, okay, sure. So 70% of white people own their homes compared to roughly 46, it may be now down to 46 a couple years ago, but we lost some home ownership thanks to COVID. But the home ownership gap is a big function of the wealth gap, because for most middle income, middle class people, their home ownership is the basis of their wealth. It provides them with all kinds of access, loans for student tuition, not to be ghetto, but loans to get folks out of jail. There are all kinds of ways that, you know, not having that access is important. And there is a nearly 30%, 25% gap between what whites own and what Blacks own. And then as Brother Man has said, when we do own, we often are paying more, often for less. And there are also studies that show that when we live in concentrated Black communities, our property, the very same property, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, is valued at less simply because of the zip code. So the whole ways that banking discriminates against us is something that should be a legal issue. And I think that the Biden administration has begun to talk about this, but they haven't talked about it enough. And what we absolutely know is that we are sidelined and disadvantaged. I won't tell any stories, but I have some. When I bought my house downtown DC, it was interesting. It was just interesting. I was told, because I was a single woman and I was a consultant at the time, that I would be offered a much higher interest rate. Praise the Lord and pass the sweet potatoes for Emma Chappelle, who started the United Bank of Philadelphia, and she's my soror. I was crying to her and saying, oh, no. And she said, I'm going to write you a loan. Yeah. And there are only a few Black people who can do that. Doyle Mitchell in Washington, D.C., Industrial Bank can do that. But there are only a few who can do that. If we go to conventional banking, they will rip us off.
Yeah. I only have a few minutes left, and a very few minutes. But as we, you know, move to the end of this program, I want to get some final thoughts from you about the Black-white wealth gap and the like. LaShawn, I'll start with you. Some final thoughts.
You know, really quick, Harold, I want to go back and address, because what my partners here are saying is very true, but I think it's a difference in your question that I answer. I was talking about real estate as an investment and not necessarily own it.
Well, let's be quick. I've got 2 minutes. Yeah. Be short.
And so, no, I was pointing that out. And so it's a different strategy when you're an investor versus, you know, a homeowner. And yeah. So I'm not holding on to these things to live in them. So when I made my response to that question, it was with the idea as an investment, as an asset class.
Okay. Dr. Telemach, real quick, 30 seconds.
Yeah, sure. So in general, as a teacher and educator of asset management, I think that it is incumbent on myself and those in my profession to offer all sorts of different assets to my students to let them decide what would be best situated inside of a portfolio. And typically we talk about inside of an institutional portfolio as opposed to a retail portfolio. But in general, if we are talking about the African-American white wealth gap here, there are several variables that are functions of this particular gap.
And give me one, because I'm out of time.
Sorry. All right. Sure. So I would probably say the history of segregation in this country is a fundamental distinction line of who could have what, when, and how. And so okay. If we are talking about any sort of equality, we would have to fix that line.
Okay. I'm going to have to have that be the last word, but I do want to say,
I don't get a last word.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. Like I said, time is money.
This brother took up my time. I'm going to get you, brother.
I'll let you talk to him after the program. But I do want to thank all of you for sharing your stories, Dr. Malvo, and your perspectives for tonight's conversation. I do tonight, of course, have a final thought. In today's complex financial climate, it's giving us new definition to the old hip-hop phrase, I've got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Attitudes about financial literacy in the African-American community have changed some, but apparently not enough to close the black-white wealth gap. That can change if we not only educate ourselves about how money works, but also evolve in answering the money question, what's it going to take to build wealth? I'm Harold Fisher. Thank you for watching and listening. Good night.